Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cornerstone at the Confluence, Navigating the Colorado River Compact's Next Century. Edited by Jason A. Robison. Narrated by Graham Rowett. Foreword. Climate change. It is what I've worked on for the past 20 years. It is what keeps me up at night, and what most people want to talk to me about. It is a source of connection between my life's work and that of my family members during the 19th and 20th centuries. Increasingly, it is the news every day, usually in the form of a natural disaster somewhere or a new, depressing study about our collective fate. Ultimately, those two words, along with Colorado River, link together the chapters of this volume. The Colorado River Basin, like watersheds everywhere, is unquestionably showing the effects of human-caused warming. For starters, temperatures in the basin are up about 1.7 degrees Celsius since 1895, with some areas exceeding 2 degrees Celsius. Until recently, precipitation declines have been modest, but not exceptional. However, 3 of the past 4 years will be in the bottom 15 of all years since 1895, and these precipitation declines may be here to stay, if not worsen. Between losses due to higher temperatures and losses from reductions in precipitation, river flows are now down nearly 20% since 2000. Up to half of that decline has been attributed to climate change. Looking forward, one 2020 study in Science projects potential future declines of 40% by 2050 due to higher temperatures and lower precipitation. Other related changes are afoot, too. The distribution of high and low flow years in the basin is now vastly different from the 20th century. High flow years occur only half as often as they did before 2000, and flows below 10 million acre feet, MAF, per year occur 2.5 times as frequently. If you randomly select years from the pre-drought periods, 1906 to 1999, only once in 1,500 years will you get a drought as severe as the one that has persisted since 2000. This hot, dry drought has been going on so long and is so severe that scientists are now saying it is something different. Aridification, the long-term drying and warming of the American West. A recent soil moisture study confirmed this, determining that the period from 2000 to 2018 was the second most severe in the past 1,200 years. We are officially in a mega drought, a drought lasting decades. The basin's reservoirs tell this story. Since 2000, Lake Powell and Lake Mead have collectively lost about 30 MAF, roughly 1.4 MAF per year. The latter figure is just about equal to the structural deficit, a phrase generally referring to the amount of water overuse in the lower basin. A recent study found, with a continuation of current flows since 2000, Lake Powell and Lake Mead will decline by another 10 MAF, only stabilizing once lower basin demands are curtailed at levels on par with the structural deficit. In conjunction with the centennial year, Lake Powell's and Lake Mead's combined storage is expected to fall below 30%, and the first ever shortage declaration will be in effect along the lower Colorado River. Completely emptying these reservoirs should never be an option, especially after 22 years of unmistakable warnings from nature. We must do everything in our powers to avoid that fate. Inflows to Lake Powell since 2000 point to another problem. Because of climate change and upper basin consumptive uses, these flows have averaged only 8.3 MAF per year, down almost 30% from the average between 1964 and 1999. Subtracting evaporation, 500,000 acre feet annually, and adding the upper basin's contribution of treaty flows to Mexico required by the compact, 750,000 acre feet annually, The Upper Basin's ability to meet that document's 10-year running delivery commitment at Lee Ferry is now in doubt. Any additional decreases in runoff or increases in Upper Basin demand will reduce Powell inflows further, opening the door to a contentious discussion about what that delivery commitment really means. The lack of agreement over such fundamental issues is more than problematic. These facts are well known and not in dispute. The real question is, what do we do? Many aspects of the law of the river are no longer tenable under the declining flows of climate change. With respect to the 100-year-old compact, multiple promises in that document present irreconcilable conflicts. As just described, the Upper Basin cannot continue to develop water supplies without running the risk of violating its delivery commitments at Lee Ferry. Any violations of this sort will lead to a discussion of every other disputed aspect of the compact, including many never-resolved ambiguities explored in this volume. It needs to be noted that new Upper Basin water projects are not merely theoretical. Utah's Lake Powell pipeline and the expansion of the Homestake project in Colorado are but two examples. The state of Utah just created a new entity to develop its unused, by 1922 standards, Colorado River apportionment, and the Upper Colorado River Commission has a demand schedule that grows Upper Basin demands significantly over the next 30 years by nearly 1.5 MAF. Similar issues abound at the Centennial. The Upper Basin will insist that their current consumption of about 3.9 MAF per year from the river system, excluding nearly 550,000 acre-feet of reservoir evaporation losses, is well below the 7.5 MAF agreed upon in the compact and, critically, that they were promised the 7.5 MAF allocation regardless of how long it would take to develop. Being out-competed by the faster-growing Lower Basin was a risk the Upper Basin thought they removed in 1922. In a related vein, what determines surplus under the compact, and which states are actually responsible for Mexico's treaty water? And, most fundamentally, which states should bear the risk of declining flows over time? That is, climate change. Do the compact's delivery commitments really put all of the climate change risk solely on the Upper Basin's shoulders? In a system with ample water, such as existed before 2000, these questions did not require answers. Unfortunately, the basin's recent hydrology exposes these long-standing conflicts and the accompanying need to resolve them. The Lower Basin has its own serious issues. The compact allows the Lower Basin to consume unused Upper Basin water, and the Lower Basin has done just that for several decades. Lower Basin uses, plus Mexico, have been about 10.4 MAF per year, while required Lake Powell releases plus tributary inflows above Lake Mead have totaled about 9 MAF per year, an annual deficit of 1.4 MAF. With higher average flows, this deficit could be covered from unused Upper Basin water. But since 2000, there has been no excess, and thus the difference has had to come from reservoir storage or reductions in Lower Basin demands. Not coincidentally, the annual loss of storage in Lake Powell and Lake Mead since 2000 averages almost this exact figure. At low reservoir levels, this overuse would be stopped temporarily by measures agreed to by the Lower Basin in the 2007 Interim Guidelines and the 2019 Drought Contingency Plan. But when those documents expire in 2025 and 2026, allocating cuts will be a major challenge. The 1968 Colorado River Basin Project Act, in theory, absolves California of any responsibility for solving the structural deficit, instead putting most of that burden on the Central Arizona Project, CAP. But drying up the CAP can't possibly work. Phoenix, a city of nearly 5 million people, now gets 50% of its water from the project. And if the Upper Basin increases its demands, they will have to be met at the expense of existing Lower Basin uses, requiring even further cuts. The compact and broader law of the river are an impossibly tangled knot, with adjustments to any one agreement impacting all others and all parties. In my search for solutions, I've often wondered how forebears like my late father, Morris, Mo, King Udall, my late uncle, Stuart, Stu, Lee Udall, or even my great-great-grandfather, the John D. Lee who founded Lee's Ferry, would react. I only know Lee through the history books, but it is clear to me that he didn't shy from a difficult challenge. He famously said, "I would want no greater punishment than to be sent on a mission to the Paria," the site of what is now Lee's Ferry. Yet just a few years later, at the request of his church, he went and established a critical ferry at that very place. To be sure, both Mo and Stu bear some responsibility for our current fate. As the congressman from the 2nd District of Arizona who shepherded the Colorado River Basin Project Act through the U.S. House of Representatives in 1968, Mo, and the Secretary of the Interior who promoted Reclamation's vision for the river, Stu, both share some blame for lower basin overuse. Both were warned there wasn't enough water in the river system, as were many others. They were not dissuaded. We're paying the price for that now. But to their credit, they knew how to learn from their mistakes, how to work with others, especially those they disagreed with, how to be humble when necessary, and how to focus on the big target. Both respected immensely the wisdom and rights of tribes in the Colorado River Basin and broader region, and actively sought to resolve injustices that these tribes still endure to this day. As chair of the House Interior Committee for nearly two decades, my father was actively involved in nearly every Indian water rights settlement, including the first one in 1978. Stu worked for years on behalf of the Navajos, who were harmed by above-ground nuclear testing. Both got their desire to do right by the tribes from their father, Levi, who penned the 1948 Arizona Supreme Court decision that finally gave Indians the right to vote, and their mother, Louise, who maintained close relations with the nearby Hopis. Across the board, their leadership mattered. We could use that sort of leadership now. The lessons of the past 22 years tell us that we're headed quickly for a drier, hotter world. We need to plan for a reasonable worst-case future, with that future modeled on the best science available. That includes taking the low flows of the past 22 years seriously, along with the potential for more flow reductions as the century continues to warm. We're in a deep hole that likely will get even deeper. Our problems arise from climate change and from kicking the difficult problem can down the road for decades. In his famous book, Water and the West, historian Norris Hundley Jr. acknowledged that many of these problems trace directly to the 1922 Compact negotiations. His second edition epilogue blamed negotiators for working in haste and refusing to call upon the scientific community for good data. They were mesmerized by their political and personal goals, and lacked sufficient accurate data to make almost any significant apportionment, according to Hundley. It is long past time that we address these problems. No water manager in their right mind would want the problems thrust upon them. Water policy is hard enough with stationary water supplies. Combined declining supplies along with unfulfilled promises, excluded parties, and new issues, and what you have is a complete mess. But the main job of water managers is to manage risk, no matter the cause or the difficulty. Managing risk in the Colorado River Basin now means focusing on how to prepare for and allocate lower flows to all deserving parties, including those historically denied a seat at the table. To paraphrase Pat Mulroy, our job now is one of equitable shortage allocation. I'm in favor of the wholesale rethinking of the law of the river, for two reasons. First, climate change is unfolding faster than anyone expected and will force our hand if we are not proactive now. And second, we shouldn't layer even more interpretations onto an already overly complex set of conflicting agreements. Anthropologist Joseph Tainter wrote a little-known but important book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, in 1988. His theory of collapse is embedded in the title. Societies collapse because they become overly complex and thus incapable of adjusting to new circumstances. I find the theory compelling and directly applicable to our Law of the River morass. Let's create a clean slate for the Colorado River system so that future generations will have a chance to solve the inevitable difficult problems of their day without being burdened by today's overwhelming, unworkable constraints. We don't often get opportunities to fix long-standing, difficult problems. Let's not waste this one. This won't be an easy lift. Providing water managers in the basin states with political cover to pursue such a broad solution will be a critical adjunct to this effort. One simple, yet perhaps unobvious way, is to also plan for a wetter future. Thankfully, that is an easy future to prepare for, and one we can all hope for, unlikely as it seems. Perhaps the notion of loans from a wetter future to a drier present, as utilized by the Lower Basin Drought Contingency Plan, could provide some cover for more painful compromises. Moe and Stew loved the word audacious, especially as it applied to leaders' actions. My father, in 1968, in front of 2,000 people in Tucson, said that his support of the Vietnam War was wrong, and that the nation needed to change its path. He was one of the first members of Congress to speak out in this way, and he did it despite his brothers being in the president's cabinet. His action was ahead of its time, as over the next few years our nation realized the war was an enormous mistake. A year later, in 1969, after a mere 8 years in the U.S. House, he challenged the 78-year-old sitting Speaker of the House, and thereby the entire seniority system. He lost, but in losing encouraged others to challenge an unfair, unjust system. Over the next few years, important reforms followed from his actions. Leadership matters. Where are our audacious leaders? Who is willing to lead us out of this hole? Who has the wisdom, the grace, the humility, the perseverance, the willingness to address past wrongs? Who can inspire and guide us? I know these people exist. We must find, promote, encourage, and support them. It is said that we can't renegotiate the compact. I think that phrase mostly comes from people who either want to deny the current situation, run from it, or preserve an untenable status quo. Regardless of how we describe our adaptations, we have to fix the compact and broader law of the river. Try we must, and soon, as nature is clearly not sitting around waiting. This volume contains a wealth of good ideas. Let's find the ones that work. Combine them with the resources that are needed. Identify, support, and promote audacious leadership, and solve these problems. Our solutions are how we will be judged. Time's a-wasting. Brad Udall. Introduction. Jason Anthony Robeson. The American West is on fire, and no doubt, it is not alone. Not a day has gone by this summer without new media coverage of unrelenting drought, drained reservoirs, record-shattering temperatures, all-consuming forest fires, busted or bustling farms, bullets-sweating cities, and so on down the line. Glancing at the U.S. drought monitor, a blood-red octopus hovers over much of the arid region's heart, the Colorado Plateau and the Great Basin, with elastic tentacles splaying hundreds of miles in every direction. And it's not as though the news or drought monitor are needed to glean what's going on. You can feel it, From suffocating afternoon rays trapped by urban heat islands to post-apocalyptic smoky air jetting up in bomb-like plumes over the ridgeline, or closer. It all feels smothering and smoldering. Something is off, beyond the COVID-19 pandemic. The Colorado River Compact's centennial arrives in this surreal space. No fewer than 40 million people have come to rely on the life-giving, prosperity-yielding flows controlled by this document. Signed in the colonial city of Santa Fe, New Mexico, on November 24, 1922, the compact is the cornerstone of a proverbial pyramid, an elaborate body of laws colloquially called the Law of the River, that governs how human beings use water from the river system dubbed the American Nile. History was made with the compact's drafting a century ago. Never before had Western states finessed their tense, frequently contentious relationships over coveted interstate rivers via negotiations under the U.S. Constitution's Compact Clause. Before the compact's drafting, the Supreme Court and its equitable apportionment doctrine had been the only place to go. The 1922 negotiations changed that game, and the Law of the River has amassed since. It's actually amassing right now, and in ways that will shape the Colorado River Basin and its vast environs for a generation, possibly longer. The compact's centennial could not be more serendipitous in timing. In 2000, the most severe drought in recorded history began in the basin. More than two decades later, it's still here. Drought is too tame a word, to be clear. Mega-drought, or aridification, better capture what's happening, but the cause is the same regardless. Climate change. Again, you can feel it. What it requires of human relationships with the river system is often difficult for our species. We have to adapt. We, too, have to change. The serendipity lies there. Spurred by the mega-drought, new management rules for the river system are being negotiated as the compact turns a century old, a process that must conclude by 2026. While it does not involve compact renegotiation in a formal sense, the process nonetheless holds monumental importance for everyone connected to the river system. And there have never been more of us, accounting for all of human history, than at the compact's centennial. The dependent population of 40 million people entails a form of record-breaking that parallels the climate-related events, setting new bars across the Colorado River Basin and the globe. The trends are inseparable. Not only does this population inhabit a 244,000-square-mile basin proper, including cities such as Phoenix, Tucson, and Las Vegas, it stretches into urban centers tens and hundreds of miles away. Witness 21st-century Los Angeles, San Diego, Denver, Salt Lake, and Albuquerque. Extensive agricultural areas, too, flourish from the basin's flows. Imperial Valley and Mexicali Valley irrigators turn the Sonoran Desert green year-round along the U.S.-Mexico border, and they have countless counterparts. And lest we forget those whose ancestors had been in the basin for centuries or millennia, since time immemorial, before the modern cities and farms sprouted. Native peoples. They consist of 30 federally recognized tribes, including the Navajo Nation, residing on a 27,413-square-mile reservation slightly larger than West Virginia. These people see the Colorado River system through different eyes. If we're being honest, some don't see it at all, tapping flows from vast, out-of-sight hinterlands for daily use without any sense of where their water comes from. Its origin is a living river system. Whether we're mindful of that connection or not, it exists, placing us in community, a basin community with a character as diverse as the Grand Canyon's dynamic colors and landforms. There's no universal vision within this community. Rather, people's wide-ranging reasons for appreciating, enjoying, even loving the river system have broadened considerably since 1922. Our values are plural. That, too, defines the centennial year. Cornerstone is anchored in this soil. A body of writing about the compact would be fitting based on its centennial alone. Again, a path-breaking document, warts and all. As fate would have it, however, this milestone arrives at an epic confluence. Climate change and the ongoing mega-drought are the elephant in the room, unprecedented in recorded history and forcing the often anxiety-inducing thing for human beings, change. That applies in full force to negotiations over new management rules for the river system during the next several years. An inflection point of generational significance, these negotiations involve dynamics as challenging as any the basin community has faced. Never before have 40 million people depended on the river system. Never before has the law of the river amassed its existing girth and complexity. And never before has the river system been valued for so many diverse, potentially irreconcilable reasons. In a nutshell, there is the centennial itself, and there is the uncanny confluence of events merging with the centennial. Both considerations point in the same direction. The time is ripe for conversations about the compact and broader law of the river. Cornerstone is a means to this end. It looks backward and forward in time. On the one hand, the compact's centennial cries out for reflection. What exactly is the Colorado River Compact? How has the cornerstone been built upon over the past 100 years? Who has done this building and why? Such questions are springboards for gaining a better understanding of the magical corner of North America that is the basin. On the other hand, they are not enough. Past is prologue, as the old saying goes, and the compact's first and second centuries are bound by a seam in time. What should become of the compact and the accompanying parts of the law of the river eyeing the future? This question calls for nothing less than self-determination, and any centennial volume would be bankrupt absent the courage to address it. The basin community is living in interesting times. They require expert navigation and navigators. For as goes the Colorado River system, so goes the fate of the hydraulic society founded atop it. This two-part lens, looking backward while looking forward, applies to a range of topics as open as the western sky. That's where Cornerstone glances. Apportionment is where the volume begins. It's where the compact negotiations began in 1922, and it's something that will always be top of mind for the law of the river. Beyond shedding light on the current allocation rules along the river system, this part takes on a topic as thorny as any for the basin's future. With the mega-drought now in its third decade, and a precarious imbalance between water supplies and demands facing the basin community, what should become of the status quo? Incremental changes may be pragmatic, but transformational changes may be necessary. Policymakers will have to land somewhere along this spectrum while negotiating the new management framework, and beyond. Whatever happens with apportionment in coming years, domestically and internationally, one thing cannot be lost sight of. The source of the flows is flush with life. It is, again, a living river system, marking the volume's next focus, environment. The compact negotiators did not see the river system as animate in 1922, nor did U.S. and Mexican treaty negotiators in 1944. But times have changed in the 21st century, and cultural norms, among other factors, have shifted. How should the law of the river adapt? To what extent can it? These tensions also loom large at the centennial, and not just for human beings with connections to the river system, but, of much greater import, for the far richer, more than human world. Native peoples have seen, and continue to see, the river system as animate, though tribes vary in their cultural and spiritual traditions. The volume takes up native peoples, the basin's 30 federally recognized tribal sovereigns, in the following part. Their importance cannot be overstated. That's partially because of historical marginalization in the compact and successive pieces of the Law of the River. This history needs to be told and sat with in main...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?